This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Chris, what is your background?
I'm a master armourer. And what that means is, instead of working on modern firearms, that means working on suits of armour. I was master armourer to the Royal Armouries for a while in residence at the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds. I'm the first master armourer to have their mastership officially recognised in England since the 17th century. And my mark, like a silversmith's hallmark, is registered in something called the Baron de Cosson Index. So I started out by actually making reproductions of armour.
When you say you make, what does that mean?
That means actually copying 100% what people would think of as suits of plate armor, the sort of thing that was used in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries.
Okay, well, let me be more specific. Do you? I mean, are you type of blacksmith? Do you actually physically go and make it with a?
Yes, no. Blacksmith is naughty. Armourers historically had issues with the blacksmiths because blacksmiths were not allowed by law to make armour. It was I have a forge, hammers, various types of special anvils called stakes, and you form the metal over it, red hot. So in that sense, yes.
No. So what is that rivalry then? I had no idea.
Because in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, crafts were very strictly limited in what they could do. And armour is such a specialist thing that if people were producing sort of El Cheapo versions on the side, then guilds had something called rights of search. They could have your door kicked down in the middle of the night and the city watch would come in and inspect what you were doing. So this, you know, it was for the protection of the craftsman, yeah, but it was also for the protection of the customers. In the 16th century in the Italian city of Brescia, it took 12 people to make a sword. That's everyone from the, yeah.
What?
You had the bladesmith to make the blade. You had somebody to make the guard, you know, the elaborate swept guard they had then. Then you had someone to make the actual grip. Then you had someone to make the cast iron pommel. Then you had someone to make the scabbard, et cetera, et cetera. And what that did was, yeah, you might think it's a bit overdone, but it made sure the quality was incredible in everything they did. Someone who made blades would be good at making blades. There were even poor buggers who did nothing but make rivets. Can you imagine that as a career?
Shame. That, Chris, that is incredible. I didn't know that. You know, when you watch a movie, it's one guy, you know, and you see him hammering away at the metal and it's all sort of epic. Mm. I religiously watched Forged in Fire. In fact, I love the show much that I interviewed one of the judges, Jay Nielsen, who's considered one of the best bladesmiths in the world, I believe. And I actually ended up learning how to make my own knife. And it was a lot of work.
Indeed. You know, to give you an idea of, you know, that blades are very good. A friend of mine called Barry Scott, that was a long time ago. He's a custom bladesmith and he used to make knives for special forces. So they had to not fail at crucial moments. And he once made a knife for me as a present, and we got a steel bar and he hacked lumps out of the steel bar with the blade and then handed me the blade and it was still sharp. It was absolutely beautifully made.
Sheesh.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
So your specialty is what?
Well, originally my specialty was the forging of plate armor. So think of a knight in a suit of armor, and I would make all the components of that: helmet, breastplate, backplate, you know, arms, legs, all the bits and pieces. And in time, but also working on my own, because we're now in the modern world, not in the 15th or 16th century, I then have to do stuff like polishing it, putting the lining inside it, because these things had to have padded liners inside them. If you stick a metal helmet on your head and you get whacked over the head, even with something like a rolling pin, it's going to hurt like hell. So they were very carefully lined as well. The fingered gauntlets had individual leather gloves sewn into them so you could, you know, use the sword properly. And these armors were light and they stopped weapons because they were expensive. And what would the point be for a professional warrior of slowing yourself down by putting on a heavy suit of armor that didn't stop weapons? You know, in Hollywood, you see people getting arrows shot through them. You see swords cutting through them. Yeah, yes. It's crap. It's absolute crap. We have plenty of examples of armors with what are called proof marks all over them, where they were shot from 30 paces with things like crossbow bolts and arrows. And then later they were shot at with firearms, and they left the marks in them as marks of proof because they had proved that the armor worked.
So in those days, did they have what we would see today as branding, like good brands? Like that's a good make, and that's not a good make.
The biggest armor producing center in Europe was the city of Milan in Italy. And they produced in the 15th century, they were conservatively producing something like 25,000 armors a year of different types. There were 200 or 300 workshops in the city. And the most important family-run workshop was run by a family called the Missaglia. So that was the Ferrari of the day. And in Germany...
And it was all handmade. And it was all handmade.
They had for the...
I mean, they didn't...
For the really heavy stuff, they had water-powered, what are called trip hammers. So you have canals running through Milan, and you would have a water wheel in the canal. That would be turning, and that would be operating a mechanical hammer to forge down really heavy plate. But there would still be a guy holding it with pairs of tongs. So it's not, you couldn't just put these things into a press, you know, a huge Japanese machine, and boom, out comes a perfectly formed helmet. You have to forge everything individually. Then you have to make the plates fit together because they worked on internal leathers like Venetian blinds, and the plates were connected with rivets that worked in slots so they'd slide. So the whole thing would flex and move with you. You know, that's a really particular skill.
Yeah, so I'm guessing the art form is creating this armor that's almost at one with your body.
Yeah, it's an exoskeleton. And armor is always a compromise between protection and mobility. You know, protection, yes. Challenge a tank, mobility, riding a bicycle in a loincloth. You know, you're going to get shot to hell doing one, but you're safe in the other, but your movement is heavily restricted. So armor is always a form of compromise.
But what sort of armies generally were more successful? Those who had more mobility or those who had more armor?
Depends on the theater of war, because you get some areas like Eastern Europe where the horse is, and Far East, where the horse is an archery platform. So you've got very mobile hit-and-run tactics. And then in Western Europe, you have the cavalry charge in the 15th into the 16th century, heavily armed men-at-arms. They've got armor themselves. Their horses are armored, and they charge in a rank using lances. And then behind them, there are ranks of more lightly armored sort of squires. And you would then have infantry, sometimes very heavily armored infantry, sometimes lighter infantry. Same thing, missile troops versus hand-to-hand combat troops. The Swiss were particularly successful from the 14th through into the 16th century with infantry armies that used long pikes, and they pioneered formations known as hedgehogs. You've got to imagine anywhere up to about 10,000 people in a square, all armed with 16-foot pikes. And if you charge at that with a horse, you're not going to do anything. So it all depended on the terrain and also the sort of missile weapons they had available to them, because we start off with bows and crossbows, and by the 15th century firearms are in pretty widespread use, and by the end of the 15th century they pretty much eclipse other form of missile weapons. So then you've got basically modern armies starting to develop. And then by the time we get through into the 17th century, eventually someone has the bright idea of, instead of having some guys with pikes and some guys with muskets, they take something that looks like a dagger and they plug it into the end of the musket barrel. And suddenly you've got a soldier who can fire and then defend himself. And that becomes what eventually the 18th century infantryman, armed with a musket and a bayonet.
You're referring mostly, though, to European armor, right?
Yeah, I mean, once you go over into Eastern Europe and then the Far East, it all changes. To go with this missile form of combat, they have more what's called a lamellar armor. So these are armors which are not solid plates. They're often made up of individual, narrow rectangular lames, we call them, and they're laced together vertically with things like silk. And that's where you get the samurai armor from. That's why in Kurosawa's films, you see these guys with great square shoulder guards and they've got rows and rows of silk because the whole thing is flexible. And that in itself can stop missiles, because missiles hitting that, the kinetic energy of the missile can be soaked up by the looser form of the armor. A bit like during World War II, people used to have net curtains. When there was risk of a bomb blowing in their windows, the net curtain would absorb the force. Mm. Same thing.
How heavy would you say is a full body armor?
Right. Depends on the period. Let's say a full plate armor from the 15th century, the Great Age, and that would be about 25 kilos or 50 pounds.
That's quite heavy.
It's distributed all over the body. So, and it's flexible, moves with you, and the most expensive ones were carefully made to measure. So it's not like wearing, a 60-pound pack on your back and having to march along. It's distributed all over you.
See what you're saying.
To give you an idea of how flexible they were, they didn't have to be winched into the saddle with cranes. They were expected to be able to vault into the saddle in armor without using the stirrups. And also, and this comes from period descriptions, of a fully armed man-at-arms was expected to be able to put his armor on and without the helmet, turn a cartwheel. So you can't do that if you're wearing something which is extraordinarily heavy and cumbersome.
And what is on the inside of the armor?
They were lined.
Leather?
They were lined with padded textiles. And that was stuffed with sheep's fleece, cheaper stuff, a form of tow, which is a form of grass. And these survived. They're rare because a lot of times they rot, or they were stripped out in the 19th century because they were looking a bit scuzzy and collectors didn't like that sort of thing. Or if they were in places like the Tower of London, the old rotting liners from all the helmets they had on the walls, they just took them out and got rid of them. So they're actually quite rare. Some of them are beautiful. They're embroidered silk or pure silk velvet. You've always got to think of armor as the scale from a secondhand broken down Fiat Panda up to a brand new Ferrari supercar. You had all the levels of quality in between.
And there was a whole market for this. I mean, people were obviously trading this. It was an industry.
It was a military industrial complex. Milan was exporting all over the known world. And not just Milan. You had Milan, Brescia, Florence, further down the Italian peninsula. The Missalia opened up an officina in Naples. And then go north, and you've got cities like Innsbruck, Augsburg, Nuremberg, even London. Latterly, they had the Royal Armouries at Greenwich. So you have armour-producing centres everywhere, and they're making very large quantities. And they're doing this. The armourers are busy not just with making new stuff all the time, but just like a car, at the end of a season, your armour's going to come back in for a service because you've been out in all weathers. You may have broken straps, broken internal leathers, the liner may be ripped, you may have had some damage to it from a weapon. So the armourers were very often, we've got accounts of what's in armourers' workshops at a certain time, and there are dozens and dozens of pieces they're working on, and they can't all be brand new.
What about rust?
Ah, yep. And now we come to the whole idea of, was armor shiny and bright or not? Here we go. Well, there you go. Good segue. Okay, so to give you an idea of what armor really looked like, most of it looked like this. See that? That's a
very
a piece I made. That's an embossed dolphin. See, it's knocked out of a flat sheet.
I mean, that's not white and shiny.
No, it's not. And what we do is we've got this idea of knights in shining armor. But now I started off, like Dick Dellingpole, I used to do reenactment shows. So I started making armor for reenactors like everyone else. I thought, oh yeah, I've got to keep this stuff brightly polished. And I know the sinking feeling when you're out at a show somewhere and there's even a light shower and you're standing there getting rained on thinking, oh no, you know, now that's my Saturday night gone. I'm going to, instead of going to the pub, I'm going to be cleaning this stuff for hours. And that's a basic thought because this is professional protection, so PPE, people would call it now, personal protection equipment, which you're going to go and wear in all weathers. You're going to march around in it, you're going to ride your horse in it for months at a time. And if you do that with a bright, shiny armor, it's going to rot. So this dull finish, here's another one. Another one there. Slightly brighter finish, but it's gray, that one instead of black. And this comes from the manufacturing process, because if you think of wrought iron or when you were making your blade, when it was being forged in the fire, it was covered in fire scale. It was grey. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So instead of cleaning that off, what they did was they left it on. And we've got lots of documents describing great inventories of arsenals full of armour. And there are only very few pieces which are described as white. Now, when I moved on from making to doing restoration work, which was the bulk of my career, I began, when I was cleaning armor, refurbishing it, re-leathering it, and making new pieces for these armors, I began finding traces of color finishes everywhere. You know, underneath rivet heads, between plates, and you can get a real kick sometimes out of dismantling something and knowing the last person to see the surface you're looking at was the guy that made it. And that might have been 500 or 600 years ago. That's quite something. What that sort of work also teaches you is how color finishes change over time, how even protective color finishes can change or corrode. And so you know when you're looking at a surface, even on a, before you start work on something, you can get a good sense of what you're going to find when you start taking it apart. Now, with your knife, did you fully harden and temper it?
No, I think it was more of a rushed job to get, you know, to get okay. to the end.
So you know that with a carbon steel, that is a steel which has got a percentage of typically for armor somewhere around 0.3, 0.4% carbon, that allows you to harden it. You heat it up in the fire to a red,
yes.
and then you quench it in a bath of water or oil.
Yeah, that's what I did, yes.
Now, if you do that to a high degree, you get a steel which is called glass hard. And it's glass hard because you can shatter it. And I did it once as a demonstration, hardened up a piece of carbon steel and then smacked it on my anvil and it broke. Now, a little bit of background, hence the expression losing your temper. You break, you snap when you lose your temper. Because to avoid that happening, armor was often, and edge weapons were re-tempered by giving them a quick clean and then heating them up so they went through a color range. And that color range started at yellow and then brown. That would go into purple and then blues and then eventually into grays and then into reds. And you can choose which color to then re-quench it at, which fixes the temper. So you get a steel which is hard but springy. Now, those colors are what then get used to produce the color, the range of color finishes we see on armor, which could be anything from pale blue, dark blue, excuse me, black, gray, all sorts. Sometimes just left with a hammer finish.
But it was never this beautiful, shiny white that you see in movies and in cartoons.
Sometimes. We do occasionally have pieces which were white. They're described as white armor in inventories. But we see it, ironically, more at the end. 16th and 17th century inventories, we get lots of helmets for troops with firearms, which are white, but not full white armors. And part of the work I did was comparing the color finishes I was finding to paintings and sculptures. I began looking at art as reference for my work on armor, and then sort of fell in love with art for its own sake later on. But what you find is the same could be pale blue, could be dark blue, could be grey finish that you see in a painting, you then find on the plates themselves, underneath rivets hidden. Sometimes it survives in quite good condition on lots of the surfaces. And then, you know, we also get references to these in documents. They talk about armour which is peacock blue or sanguine. Yes. Or azzurro in Italian for pale blue, all these different colours. And what happens is when you re-quench to temper a piece like that, if you do it into an oil bath, you create an oxide layer which is stable. So your armour is then pale blue, dark blue, black, purple. There you go. And there's one document which specifically says you want these colour finishes so the armour will keep the longer from rust.
But what you're ultimately telling me is that the idea of a knight in shining armour is largely a myth.
Sorry. it triggers people immensely. Because if you have, for instance, if you had a knight from the 15th century, and he came back to a modern-day reenactment show and he saw these hundreds of guys in these glittering white armors, he'd think, what the hell are they wearing? Interestingly, where we do have white armor and references to white armor, it's for a specific reason. There's a Spanish document which mentions white armor as being appropriate for novice knights, so like for squires. So if you like, this is this sense of purity. So the polished armor for the squires in 15th century Spain is like you're passing out uniform at Sandhurst, and of course nice smart uniform, but when you get out into the field you're wearing battle fatigues. So it's the same thing. The actual grey armour often that these people would wear, it's a colour called russet, was nothing like what squires would wear. Now, you do just occasionally get people wearing white armour in paintings, and you see some saints wearing white armour in paintings, and it's always with this sense of purity or holiness associated with it, rather than, you know, everyday wear. There's one inventory of a castle in a place called Pavia in Italy, and there are 2,665 armors or pieces of armor in the arsenal. And how many white bits of armor do you think there are for a warrior?
I have no idea.
One.
No, it can't be that
helmet.
Few.
One helmet and seven pieces of horse armor, and it states it specifically. So there you go. Over 2,500 bits of armor, one white helmet. So you can't get away from this. You've got colored armor shown in paintings. We've got colored armor described in documents. I was finding evidence of color all over the armors I was working on and on edge weapons. And so it sort of flips the idea of the shining armor on its head. If you've got evidence of color finishes, if you've got color finishes in paintings, if you've got descriptions of color finishes, why would you think armor was white?
Well, for what it's worth, if it was European, then what we do know is that at least the soldiers were white.
I was thinking before the pod, I was thinking, God, I keep talking about white armor as if it's some sort of ethnic group of armor.
Chris, we don't do racism.
No, fine. Sorry about that. I stand corrected.
There's an incredible segue that I want to make here, and I have absolutely no idea how to join.
Good luck.
How to join these two talking points, and I think you know exactly where I'm going with this.
Yes.
One of your other interests is a place called Tartaria, and I don't know how to link these two talking points.
I can do it for you.
Okay.
In the 17th century, they had special armor they wore in trenches, right? Which is appropriate for this podcast, obviously. And trenches could be full of mud. So we pass from armor.
There we go.
We pass from armor to mud, and the dreaded mud floods. Right. Shall I?
This is something that you've been researching on the side for a very long time, isn't it?
This is something which touched my radar quite recently.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about Tartaria, we're only talking, 150 years or something. So a long time.
I see what you mean.
So a long time can be last week.
Indeed. Apparently, 1,000 years of history went missing somewhere, or got faked up. This touched my radar recently because I'm used to working with historical artifacts and documents and paintings and buildings. I've written two books about the historical architecture of the city of Florence. I've been immensely privileged to be able to work in the archives there. And when you order a document, you don't get a microfiche or a photocopy unless it's a very, very precious document. What you get is the real thing. You sit down at the desk and then they bring you these amazing handwritten documents. The oldest one I looked at was from the end of the 14th century. And they're beautiful and they're beautifully written. So when this whole Tartaria thing touched my radar and mud floods, one of the things which triggered me was the idea that this event, this amazing civilization happened sometime in the 19th century. No one's ever quite sure about when. And this amazing civilization, which had advanced technology, free energy, these things, was wiped out by a cataclysm or series of cataclysms, which seems to revolve around the bottom floors of the buildings being filled up by mud floods. And instead of bouncing back from this global disaster, somehow the entire civilization collapsed, and there is no memory of it. And also the inference is, therefore, that the documents in the archives, the places I've been working, are all either adulterated and buildings have had dates altered, or these documents are completely forged. And it was that which began to trigger me a bit, because I just thought, have you no idea how many historical documents there are in these places? The city of Florence has literally tons of them. There's the National Archive, the National Library, the Mocerola Library, the archive of the bishopric. Then there are the different church archives. There's the Laurentian Library. It goes on and on and on. And before everything was computerized in the National Archive where I worked, there was an entire room for the index. That was it. Three walls of index cards, catalogues of thousands upon thousands of documents. So I see that the people who are debunking this stuff online tend to do it from the idea of the mud flood is silly, because what are actually basement flats in buildings are supposed to have been ground floors of buildings that were flooded with mud. And afterwards what happened was they sort of dug away the front, and what were the ground floor windows and now basement windows to let light in. I came at it, now that is in itself really silly. I can use, to just get rid of that, I can use one local example. The building I'm sat in is 17th century and it has a beautiful cantina. It has a basement, because they were built historically into these buildings to store food, to store wine and oil. And in the bigger palazzi, they used to stable their horses down there. So, subterranean structures in these buildings are normal. And if you walk along the street outside here, you will see these little tiny windows at street level, and that's to let light and sometimes air into the storage areas, okay? Right. So the people advocating the mud flood theory would say that the street level here must have come up by about 2.5-3 meters, leaving what had been the ground floor submerged. Okay, we can get rid of that quite easily. I'm in the town of Fossano in Piedmont. Okay, Fossano is on a tongue of rock that sticks out into the plain, and it's 100 feet above the plain. The plain stretches from here across to the Alps, 12 miles before you reach the foothills. If you go to the south, similarly, that's 14 miles. And if you go to the north, that's about 30 odd miles. So you're talking about a flat plain, which is about 600 square miles. Okay. But it's 100 feet lower than where I'm sitting. So to flood this city centre, you would first have to flood the entire plain to a depth of 100 feet or more with water or mud before it would even touch this place. Try and work out that in terms of volume. You've got 600 square miles by a depth of 100 feet. That's a lot of mud. So the first question is, right, so the first question is, where did it come from? Because that's a huge volume of material.
Well, that would say maybe an earthquake or something like that, or a volcano. Okay. I don't know. No, not a volcano, but perhaps from under the ground somehow.
But you would still have to fill up the entire plain to this level before you could start to flood this town, okay? Now, down on the plain, there are naturally dozens of little towns and villages with historical buildings in them. So let's give the mud flood the benefit of the doubt and say it actually happened. Wow, it flooded the entire plain to that depth. How did they dig out the towns and villages afterwards? Because those buildings have been down there hundreds of years. So not only have you got the problem of where did all the material come from, you've got the slightly inconvenient fact of where did it go?
One of the arguments is that the windows that are under the ground, and I've seen that in Europe, but a lot of that has to do with taxes and all sorts of other stuff. I mean, it wasn't because of mud. It was just because of I don't know, architectural slash political slash financial reasons.
In the 17th century in England, there was a window tax. So people, rather than pay it, they bricked up their windows. And similarly, there was a hearth tax. So they used to stop up chimneys as well, or have more than one fireplace going into one chimney, which led to some people being burned to death. Law of unintended consequences. The thing as well is, and now we're going to come back towards the historical side of this. The documents I work with interlock. If we, and by the way, this Tartarian thing, we apparently, buildings that are now things like the Capitol building in Washington and other buildings all around the world are supposed to be far older than they are. But, and we didn't have the technology to build structures like that. Well, yes, we did. Because when I was growing up, I was reading stuff about the Victorian engineers like Isambard Kingdom Brunel. The Victorians were some of the greatest builders ever. As engineers, they were absolutely fantastic. And you go back in time to medieval and Renaissance Italy, and they were building things like the Dome of Florence Cathedral and St. Peter's. They were absolutely incredible builders. But what we have is an interlocking set of documents and objects and buildings and paintings and even suits of armor that all reference each other. So if you go into the National Archive in Florence, you can look up a will, right? You get out a will. And that will have been annotated by someone else. So then that links to another document when the case is opened, and then finally the will is concluded when everything's been dispersed. And that I was looking at wills for armourers, but they then tell you where they owned property. So you've then got links to maybe leases or contracts. And so you have documents that reference documents and documents that are compiled and put into inventories of documents all in the same period. Then you have references to objects in those documents. Those objects could be paintings. I mean, for something like Florence Cathedral, we got the documents for the competition that was held to design the dome of the cathedral. So we've got models that were produced for these buildings. We've even still got some of the tools and machinery they used to make them. So, You see what I'm starting to come to is to fake this amount of information is starting to become absolutely impossible. Then you have paintings of some of those buildings and paintings of people, and those paintings are signed and dated. So we then have known painters working at a known point for known people or on, you know, I don't know, views of Florence. It's more and more and more interlocking evidence. And, of course, the buildings survive now as well. So go on.
One of the strange anomalies of this Tartarian narrative is that there was this region which was called Tartaria, and it was a name of multiple subregions. Mm-hmm. But these mud floods and the technology and whatever else that goes on in the story affected the whole world. But like, what about us down here at the bottom tip of Africa? It didn't affect us. I mean, we've got records in history going right back to the 1600s.
Yeah. So
it just missed us altogether.
Yeah. Well, likewise, it missed my family, because the other little fly in the ointment here is family tradition, folk memory. This is why I think this idea of the great replacement along with this is also suspiciously convenient, because if everyone was wiped out, well, that's okay, there are no witnesses. So you would have comments in letters, you'd have comments in diaries, even in the first pages of family Bibles, where people would write down important events. So, you know, my grandmother, who died a few years ago, was born, she got to 100, and she was born right at the beginning of the 20th century. And she used to tell me about things that went on in the family in the 19th century. Now, if there'd been some cataclysmic mud flood in the UK, the family would have held the memory of it. You can't just have collective amnesia, which wipes the whole thing. Doesn't work. And this also works with the documents I've been talking about, because they interlock going back 1,000 years. And that's before we get to classical texts. So the idea...
Chris, I wonder... Yeah, no, sorry, just, go so on.
The idea that somehow this happened, all of these documents have been fabricated to shove history back by 1,000 years, and then somehow dovetailed into the, living memory, and nobody noticed. It's just daft.
I was going to say, do you think it could be part of an agenda to wipe out Western knowledge, Western culture?
This is why I wanted to mention it on the podcast. At first, when I looked at these things online, I mean, you can watch these films, and like you were talking with Bob Moran about satire, and Bob said it's best to treat these things as satire, and then they're just incredibly funny. And I made that mental adjustment watching a couple of films and laughed my ass off while I was watching them. But unfortunately, what followed on from that was a bit of a bad feeling. I just began to get this really off feeling about the whole thing, because it's inversion. Inversion is not a good thing. That's, you know, Luciferian, satanic. So it's, and I began to think,
yeah.
What we're told is this all happened, but no evidence is provided for it, no actual evidence. Then we're told to discount all the evidence that there is, which is incontrovertible. So this completely inverts the concept of truth and evidence for something. Also, there's the idea that if you want to do what I'm doing now, I have to disprove these things. No, if you tell me the moon is made of green cheese, it's for you to prove it. It's not for me to phone Elon Musk, get a space on the rocket, go up there and check. It's for you to do it. If you make it through the Van Allen belts, which I somehow don't. Yes.
Of course.
Okay.
Sure.
So then.
But maybe you could make some armor.
Some special armor. Yeah, anti-radiation armor. You know, now here's a thing which will get people going. When we went to the moon, before going, NASA went over to the White Tower and they studied one of Henry VIII's armors, so they could have this so they could have this articulated protecting thing. They even had a spacesuit on show in the White Tower next to the armor at one point. You know, just a nice bit of gaslighting going on there. But I began. I mean, you've got to first of all invert everything. Then it's if you don't yes. believe us, prove us wrong. That's not how it works.
Yeah. Then, yeah, put the onus exactly. on you.
And proving a negative is incredibly difficult. Then what you have is the complete suspension of common sense. Because everything I've been blathering on about now is just basic common sense. This is along the lines of if you went out during COVID to a pub, you had to sit down and eat a scotch egg to avoid being killed by a lethal virus. But if you...
Because it would fly over your head if you stood up.
It would fly over your head before you stood up. And if you did stand up, you put a mask on, you'd be safe. Right?
Yes.
Now, that is just ridiculous enough as it is. The mudflood Tartaria thing is next level. This is Olympic level, suspend your common sense. And that's another...
But yes, yeah, but something I've just realized. I mean, it feeds into what you were saying, and that is, it's also part of an agenda, a deliberate agenda to create confusion, yep. so that nobody yep. knows what reality is. And when you don't know what's going on anymore, you are easily controlled.
Right. Now, there's several things it does, and then a little bit of philosophy to go to the point you're making. What it does is it makes the whole truth or freedom movement look ridiculous, because all you've got to yes. do is look at the people who are debunking this online, and they lump all of the things. So you could talk about Kennedy, the moon landings, 9/11. It all gets lumped in with this stuff. So we are portrayed as absolute fruitcakes. And what that will do is in a time when people are starting to look up and notice the chemtrails, and they're chemtrailing the hell out of us here all the time. When people are starting to ask questions about that sort of thing, if you then introduce something like this, it will put a hell of a lot of people off going anywhere near it. Because, you know, if you start asking questions about stuff like that, oh, you're not one of those people that believes in mud floods, are you? Yeah. So that's one thing. The next thing is, of course, it will create division and conflict within what could loosely be called the truth movement.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an art of war strategy.
Exactly.
You don't need to actually attack your enemy if you can get your enemy to attack itself.
And look, when I published the book about the original colors of armor, boy did I get some flack for that, because I completely trashed a lot of cherished ideas. And by saying what I'm saying now, I wouldn't be at all surprised if I don't get a few unsolicited emails from people who take exception to what I'm saying. So this is it feeds into human nature as well. People like to be in on a discovery. People like to be the go-to person on a subject. And yet, what you've got here is taking on the properties of something like a spell. Because people are repeating and repeating the same phrases. Mudflood, mudflood basement, free energy, historical resets. And it takes on an energy of its own. But the idea
of free energy, I mean, we're not chatting about that, but you just brought up the term. It's a weird concept to me, because nothing is actually free. Everything, there's always some sort of balance.
Even sunlight has a cost to the sun. So there's no such thing as free energy. Coming back to the cultural side of things, and this is where I thought, good old Marcus Aurelius, what is a thing in itself? What is its nature? What is it that it does? And the thing which really gave me the bad feeling about this, and I think it's got PSYOP written all over it, is apart from the usual distraction, division, conflict, all that sort of thing, it undermines completely Western culture. Western culture is under an absolute onslaught at the moment, and what you're being told through this is that the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, all those beautiful paintings, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, those people, it's all fabricated. That 1,000 years of history didn't exist. So what that does is it undermines the whole concept of that culture.
In fact, let's just take it one step further, because people like to say Western culture when they actually mean European or white people, yeah, effectively, and everything that comes, yeah, with that.
Absolutely. And in an area, in this what you might call the truth movement, where people are naturally disposed to mistrust official narratives, they're an easy target. If you tell people history is a lie, these things are all fabricated, they didn't exist, you are culturally, you're cutting the ground out from under people. And the people who are circulating this stuff on YouTube and on BitChute and the others, they're doing the work of the globalists for them. Because the globalists right now are having a damn good pop at Western culture, and this helps it. Not only...
You mentioned...
I was going to say, not only that, I think it even feeds into the transhumanism thing. Because if what you do is you say, not only is your culture fake, you couldn't possibly have made these buildings. I mean, I'm absolutely astonished that some people actually repeat this stuff on alternative media, that, well, it's interesting because how could we have built these things? Because we could. You know, people were absolute geniuses with their hands. So by saying this strange, mythical, highly advanced culture built all these things, and then you came along afterwards when the population was replaced magically, you couldn't have built them. So it's another thing which I believe presents us as useless meat sacks. You know, we couldn't have done these things. You could only do it if you were part of an advanced civilization. So why don't you have a brain chip?
But, Chris, I don't know how to ask this. I won't tell my wife.
Best of fine.
Do you think that there was an advanced civilization, though? Because I tend to think history is perhaps cyclical. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I'm perfectly open to, because look what I did with Coloured Armour. I just began uncovering stuff. So yeah, have an open mind always. And some of the monuments in Egypt, I think that's fascinating. I'm quite open to the idea that way back when, yes, there were machines and tools used to create some of those monuments, and they're now gone. But that's way further back in time.
Yeah, that's not 500 years or 150 years back.
So yeah, I agree with you absolutely. The idea that, yes, history is cyclical, and we never ever bloody learn from it, do we? I agree with you absolutely. Yes, in the far distant past, there may have been technologies to produce those monuments or harness energy in some way. Yep, I'm open to those possibilities. Do I think space aliens landed and gave that to us? Nope.
But you mentioned earlier, you mentioned chemtrails, and it made me wonder, going back to, you know, all the armor and steel and metal that you've worked with over the years, do you think that, I don't know, 800 years ago, 500 years ago, when they were making this stuff, the air was less polluted and affected the metal less?
Yeah. I once had...
Or doesn't it make much difference today?
I once had lunch with a building conservator from New York. And she was telling me that they've got hellish problems because the levels of pollution there attack the buildings. So, the level of pollution within the environment will change it. Also, I mean, simple things, nothing to do with chemtrails, but simple things like salt air. You know, you've got temperature gradients, acid, alkaline gradients, that sort of thing will all affect it. So if somebody is messing around with stuff in the atmosphere, yeah, it'll have an effect, I'm sure.
If if soldiers in those days lived close to the beach, did their armor get more impacted?
There's an Elizabethan document which describes armor which had to be painted black. Armor was sometimes painted with bright colors, but as a cheap fix, it was so badly corroded that it was painted black. And we got the accounts of Elizabeth I for what they charged for doing this, because it had become foul and rusty from immersion in the sea. So, yeah, I mean, for stuff for sea service, yes, if you were on board, because they had soldiers on board ships. So if you were in the, somehow at sea, yeah, it would have a hell of a problem. And I should say there is an armoury of the Knights on Malta still, and they have horrific problems with corrosion caused by the salt air. Yeah, they have to lacquer everything.
If a knight fell overboard into the ocean, I guess there was no chance that he could get that armor off quickly.
Unlikely. Very unlikely. If you had a full armor, it takes you about 20 minutes to get into it. Yes.
Shame.
Yeah, okay. Getting it off is probably slightly faster. There was one guy in the English Civil War, a guy called Sir Arthur Heselrigge, and he was a royalist, and he had a full armor down to the knee, which was all shockproof, very heavy, called a cuirassier armor. And he was attacked by two parliamentarians, and they got so close as to touch his helmet with the muzzle of a pistol and discharge it twice. Sure. And he didn't go through. Must have given him a hell of a headache. But in the end, what they had to do was shoot his horse. That brought him down. Yeah, pity. And it took him so long to try and disentangle the sword knot from round his gauntlet so he could present his sword and surrender that some friendly troops came up and saved him. So that's an example of, you know, can't get the armor off, and it actually saved him.
I've never had the privilege of actually holding one of those magnificent, majestic swords from the medieval era. I've only ever seen them on display or something. I've never actually held one in my hand. Were they very heavy?
No. Few Not. Pounds. No. Same thing again. Now, I've made copies of swords for people, and I made one which, incidentally, an Olympic martial artist had a play with, and you can balance it on your little finger just in front of the guard, and he loved it. He began Really? Talking about it as her. I got an email saying I met her. So it even had a character.
But there's something that's weird to me. Yeah, that's something that's also just changed my thinking, because I mean, I love Game of Thrones. I think it's an absolutely brilliant series, and the artwork in terms of everything that's in it is just incredible. But I remember saying to my wife, you know, when you see these scenes where a female would just pick up this huge sword and swing it like it's easy, I would say to her, nah, you know, those swords were probably very heavy. That's just, you know, that's just Hollywood. But you're saying that they were very light.
And there were in the 16th century, there were German troops called Landsknechts, and they had 6-foot swords. They were double.
Six feet long.
They were double pay men, Doppelsoldner, because they had to be very skilled at using something like that. And there's plenty of those.
What do you do with that?
Well, you don't. When you fight with a sword, you don't always just grab it by the hilt and smack someone over the head with it. There's something called half swording, where you grab the sword further down the blade, so you've already got about 2.5 feet of purchase, and then you can thrust with it, or then you can swing and cut with it. So and sometimes they'd smack the guard into someone's throat. They'd use the pommel to smash someone's skull in. All parts of a sword are weapons, not just the blade.
The armor that you have specialized in, what sort of compound is it?
What you mean, what sort of steel?
Yeah.
In modern terms, it's something like an EN45, a spring steel. Something like 0.4, 0.5% carbon. Once you start getting up into higher carbon steels, obviously it's much more difficult to work, and you have a higher failure rate on heat treatment at the end. There was one family, this is something which will surprise you. Everyone knows about Japanese and Viking swords as being what are called pattern welded. And I've done some of that. Yeah. And the Celts were doing it in the Alps here already a couple of hundred years BC. So this is another thing that this sort of technology was being used way before. But in terms of armor, there's one family called the Helmschmidt family of Augsburg. And we've got beautiful examples of their work in the Imperial Armory in Vienna. And they've sectioned bits of the armor. And it's what we'd now call a bimetal alloy. Like a Japanese sword, you have two types of carbon steel, which are forged welded together. Yeah. One is harder, like the cutting edge of a Japanese sword. In this case, it's the outside of the armor. And then you have a lower carbon steel on the inside, and they heat treat it. And when you section it with a microscope, you can see this black line running through the middle. So it's that would be like a memory metal now. You say, if amazing stuff.
The metals then were not very multiplied in terms of their compounds. I'm trying to think of that metal now where you fold different metals and you get this beautiful pattern. What's it called now?
It's Damascus. Yeah.
Do you get Damascus shields and Damascus armor plates?
That's a Middle Eastern thing. If you go to people in England can go to the Wallace Collection in London or the Royal Armouries in Leeds, and they'll see plenty of examples of that. There were pattern welded blades on swords, or they call that crucible steel. Damascus finish on axe blades, Damascus finish on body armor, on helmets. It's absolutely amazing stuff.
But what are the pros and cons?
That's a hell of a lot of work to produce a beautiful finish. Now, when you get something like a Japanese sword, and you get that beautiful pattern, the hamon, on the cutting edge. Now, that has a sort of poetry all of its own. But a friend of mine who analyzes these steels rather more prosaically says, you're just evening out the carbon in the blade. That's all you're doing. You know, you're just making a more reliable product, which is rather less romantic for fans of Japanese swords.
I've absolutely enjoyed chatting to you, Chris. How can I find out more? Do you have a website, Instagram, whatever?
Website. I'm doing a lot more work now on Italian art and history. So if people would like to come across to renaissancedissident.com, all one word, renaissancedissident.com.
Great start.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.